Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, I'm Kathy Irway, the host of Eat Your Words and Heritage Radio Network. This summer, I'm taking a little break and having co-host Talia Ralph and Brianna Kurtz host several episodes. I'll see you back in the fall.
Ooh, I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow. So satisfied. No, I ain't never, 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 never had no loving like this before.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Eat Your Words. I'm your host today, Brianna Kurtz. So here at Eat Your Words, we love talking to chefs and authors about their cookbooks and other print projects they might have going on. But today we're going to make a small departure and look at bookstores. Specifically, I'm joined by Matthew Sartwell, the managing partner of Kitchen Arts and Letters, which is a culinary bookstore located on Manhattan's Upper East Side. Hi, Matt.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So I'd love for you to tell us, what is a culinary bookstore?
Well, I think every culinary bookstore, and there are stores scattered all across the globe and around the United States, is in part a reflection of its local community. In New York, we are heavily driven by the needs of professional customers as well as people who are attempting to be innovators or researchers of food. We carry thousands and thousands of cookbooks, but that's really only about half of what we have in the store. We're also very rich in things like food history, in manuals on process and on technique. We look at things that expose or attempt to dig into food culture, not just in the United States, but all over the world. We're trying to be useful to people who are serious about food or who are thinking about getting serious about food to try and plug them in to a wider world.
And so you only sell books that deal with culinary topics, beverages. I'm not going to find a book about NASCAR or something, right?
I think we have at one point or two had a NASCAR cookbook, but I think Mr. Batali did one a few years ago. But we're really concentrated. We try to develop an expertise in certain areas. So we don't really get outside that very much. People sometimes come in looking for things that have a tangential relationship. We have a small selection, for instance, of books on gardening, but our focus is often much more on preparation. But we can show you, I would say, 50 or 60 books on Renaissance food and food of the medieval era. We're looking for very precise books where an author may burrow into a subject and pursue it with a passion that in other places might be regarded as obsessive. But for our customers, that obsession is absolutely magical, and they want to be in there, and they want to participate, and they want to learn from somebody who has had that kind of devotion to a topic.
So let's back up a little bit. How did it get started?
Well, the store has been open a little more than 30 years. We had our 30th anniversary last fall. Knock Waxman, who is the founder and is still in the store 3 days a week, was an editor who wanted to open a bookstore, and he looked for a community of people that he felt was being poorly served by general bookstores, and in an area where he was also personally passionate. He thought about opening a sports bookstore, but he decided that there were more people who were making their living in some way or another through food, and that we might be more vital by being connected to that community. So we've been on the same block of the Upper East Side. We're on Lexington Avenue between 93rd and 94th Streets. Since we opened, we moved into a larger space after being opened a year or two, and we've been there ever since. We just renewed our lease for another 7 years. And in that time, we have changed and evolved the kind of books that we carry. We've learned from our customers how focused they want to be on certain topics. And we've also learned that there are some things that may be huge national bestsellers, but which for us are simply not capturing the attention of our customers.
Is it true that it used to be a butcher shop?
Half of the store used to be a butcher shop, yes. The other side used to be a hardware store. But in the basement of one half of the store, there is an old meat locker, which we now use to sell to store vintage cookbooks.
Ah, nice. So there's some definitely like a culinary kind of lineage there.
Very definitely. And before we took the space over, it was a catering shop.
Oh, wow. So NAC is, if correct me if I'm wrong, was initiated into the James Beard Foundation Hall of Fame. And you yourself used to work with the James Beard Committee on books. Is that correct?
Yes. I was for many years a judge for the Cookbook Awards. And for 6 years, I was on the Book Awards Committee, the last three as the chair of the committee.
What era was that?
This was my first year off the committee, so I just finished. And it was a great 6 years. It's an amazing process to learn about how people evaluate cookbooks. You see all the judges at work. You read what they have to say and how different people take books apart and challenge them and what they expect of them. And the Beard process is actually pretty rigorous, and it asks a great deal of the judges who volunteer their time to do a lot of hard work. And as you see the input coming back in, you really gain an appreciation about how many great books are out there. And one reason why I liked doing it so much was that after a whole year of working in a bookstore devoted to food, the judging process exposed me to books I hadn't encountered yet. There, you can never be complacent about how much you think you know about things like book publishing.
You're very saturated. There's books around you all the time. And, you know, I'm sure with judging for the Beard Awards, you have to obviously read everything. And so does one kind of inform the other? Is there any kind of, does it reinforce your work with the Beard Awards or with at Kitchen Arts?
Oh, it was always really helpful to lift what one knew out of one and into the other and to gain some perspective. But I think all the time you learn what you don't know, and you learn where you need to grow and where you need to pursue new areas of knowledge. So that was one of the exciting things about working with the Beard Foundation. And it's been one of the same things about working in a bookstore for 22 years. I came out of book publishing. I was an editor for Penguin before I started working for Kitchen Arts and Letters. I think that I was a fool to have ever thought I could be a good editor without having been a bookseller first. You learn very differently how people use books when you see them choosing them in a store and saying, oh, I want this because it does this for me. And it's a very different exposure to the way in which people make up their minds about books and what they value in books.
And can you talk about anything that you've seen? I mean, the landscape of food has changed over that 22-year time that you've been with Kitchen Arts, 30 years for the whole time of the store. What's really been changing as far as the landscape of books? Like, what are the changes you've seen?
Well, I think there have been a couple of things that have been very noteworthy, one of which is that the general cookbook has been receding, and people are much more interested in books that offer them depth and offer them background and help them understand where food comes from and why it might be eaten in certain ways, which isn't to say that a book comes along like a great everyday book like The Spit and Kitchen, which is a terrific book for weeknight cooking and from an author who really sort of earned her chops. But at one point, that was really all that publishers put out were big general books with an occasional international cookbook. Now a book can come along like Sandor Katz's Art of Fermentation, which is a massive book that is very rich in detail and sort of obsessive. He goes into things that the squeamish people might not even want to know about. But he's there, and you know that you can follow what he's done because he's devoted himself to that. And that kind of devotion and that kind of focus, I think, is becoming much more prized, certainly among our customers. That said, there are, you know, there are a lot of people out there for whom a weeknight dinner that it doesn't come out of a bag from a fast food restaurant is something of a challenge. And everyday cookbooks in some ways have become simpler and easier to use. And we keep our eyes open for good examples among that, too, because not everybody has the time to make sauerkraut every weekend.
Well, I think single subject books are definitely a thing of the moment. Every, you know, there's one on salt, and there's one on sugar, and there's one on pork, and there's one, I mean, every week I feel like there's a new single subject book on a very, you know, finite ingredient in some ways.
Well, and I'm happy to see that continue, because I think that kind of exposure to a deeper understanding of something is very worthwhile. We may not all want to be as obsessive as these authors are, but we can profit from them. And there's a book coming out this fall by Jennifer McClagan called Bitter, and it follows a book that she did called Fat, and a book called Bones, and a book called Odd Bits. And she's done a great job of approaching subjects with a focus that really can open a cook's eyes to possibilities that can be done with food. And, you know, Bitter seems in some ways like a horrifying quality for food, but it's, we're really coming to appreciate just how much a bitter element can add to a dish. And I'm really looking forward to seeing that book when it's finished, and I have big hopes for it.
Well, and then there's all those the small yellow books Andrew Smith is the editor for, and it's the same. It's like pork and tea. I mean, everything. They have so many now.
There are a lot of series like that, and sometimes it can be a little bewildering. I have to admit, we cherry pick among them, looking for people whose work we know previously, and then sometimes taking a flyer on a subject that we've never seen a book on before. We'll be happy to go after that. The people who do here in Brooklyn, who do short stack editions, have done some great little books on things like buttermilk and strawberries and grits, and we carry those as well, because they just offer a freshness and some excitement.
I think it's really great that you can be so selective, too. You're already in a niche, but then you're like even more.
Well, I think one of the most common things people say when they come in the store and they look around, because we have about 13,000 books on the floor, and they say, you must have every book in the world. And the truth of the matter is that we don't, a long way from it. We do pick fairly carefully, and we go to some unusual lengths to get some books in areas where they're not generally available. So we bring in books from many, many countries. We have about 1,000 books in French, hundreds and hundreds in Spanish. We bring a few things from Italy. We bring stuff up from South America and Australia, because those are books that are just not well represented in the things that come from the mainstream American houses.
I definitely want to touch more on that a little bit later in the show, but I wanted to ask, kind of in this day and age of ebooks and just being an independent store of any sort, really, any kind of slow business, it's just really hard to survive. So how have you been able to do that over 30 years? What challenges have you overcome? What challenges do you still face?
Well, it's a big topic. We've been very fortunate in having customers who support us in the face of what I might say were opportunities to go elsewhere. We're very aware of the big online players in the book business and the way that they've changed how people think about books and things like book pricing. But on the other hand, we continue to pursue things that cannot be found elsewhere. I mean, I can easily walk around the store and put a stack together of 100 books that you can't find online. Or if you do find them online, you're paying a horrible premium for them because somebody realizes I've got the only one like this in the world. So we do work pretty hard to continue to offer people a value that they don't get from some of the big electronic sellers. We offer a lot of customer service. We work hand in hand with people. We talk to people. We spend time asking them questions about what they want from a book and helping them get to it. That said, we know there are people who come to see us who take our advice and walk out the door and order online. Can't really worry too much about that, because I don't want the fear of that to interfere with offering the best possible service to the people who have come into the door. We do have now, just started recently selling our more recent arrivals online. It's a small collection of books that we're going to be adding to on a regular basis, both new arrivals, and we're going to be highlighting some classic books that we think people may be overlooking in mainstream channels that are really worth spending some time with. And we're just going to continue offering as close a service as we can to people, and I think keep getting back the kind of support and feedback that we've gotten from the food community to date.
Just keep doing what you do.
And, well, we've expanded our program of events in the last year or so. We do a lot with the 92nd Street Y, which is a big New York cultural institution that's a block and a half away from us. That gives us a chance to have something where we may have 300 people get together to hear an author. We can't do that in the store.
Well, no, I mean, like, doing what you do in the sense that you're not going to let the kind of fear of outside competition change the heart of your business, and also that you're, and I've been in your store several times, and the customer service is always excellent. So, in kind of keeping that familiarity and that touch.
Definitely. We want people to be able to come in and talk to us and ask us questions and not be shy about saying, oh my gosh, I really don't know anything about this subject, and I have to sort of come up to speed on it quickly. Or sometimes people say, I had a great dinner at a Thai restaurant last night, and I don't know anything about Thai food. Can I get in there? Can I be doing that kind of thing? And we're happy to talk to people, but that makes the day for us go so fast and is so much fun. And it's that sort of talking about good books that makes the job so rewarding.
Do you work with other small bookstores across the country where if maybe a well-known independent bookstore in San Francisco says, we're looking for this book. Do you guys collaborate at all?
We trade a lot of information back and forth. Good news, bad news. Somebody tried to scam us recently, and I called a couple of our competitor stores and said, watch out. Somebody's got an act out there, and they're trying to use it, and they seem to have tailored it to a food bookstore. But there are, I don't think of those other stores like San Francisco or Seattle or Vancouver or Montreal as competitors because we're all of us special to our place, and I'm happy to send an order to somebody in Savannah or somebody in Kuala Lumpur, but I think that the fact that a store in San Francisco is thriving is better for both of us.
Yes, great. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Matt and getting into more of the details about the inventory. Stay with us.
You are listening to Baby Boy Blues by the California Honey Drops here on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
All right, welcome back to Eat Your Words here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Brianna Kurtz, and I'm speaking with Matt Sartwell, the managing partner of Kitchen Arts and Letters. So I want to talk more about the events you mentioned. What type of events are you doing? When did those kind of get started? How can people find out more?
Well, we began a very intensive event schedule last fall with the 92nd Street Y. That was the first time we'd been able to get a coordinated lineup put together. And it's been a great deal of fun. We've had Small-scale events and large-scale events. So we had, for instance, Rene Redzepi of NOMA come and visit us with 250 people in the audience. We had smaller events where just after her new book was published, Molly Katzen, of originally of Moosewood fame, and just released a new book called Heart of the Plate last fall, came and talked about the differences in vegetarian cooking between the time that she wrote Moosewood back in the 70s to now, and how much more rich vegetarian cooking had become in that time. So most of the events are an author in conversation with an interviewer, but sometimes they're participatory. We had an ice cream social with the folks from Cool House and Ample Hills Creamery here in New York. And we'll be doing some events this fall with people like Dave Arnold of Booker and Dax.
One of my fellow co-hosts here at, not my co-host, but a show host here on Heritage Radio Network.
Well, Dave's book Liquid Intelligence is out this fall, and we'll be having a lot of fun doing an event with him, but we'll have Sean Brock of Husk and McCrady's with us for the fall, and another event with Yotam Ottolenghi. And all those things are a chance for people to get to interact with the authors and to learn about them in a much more personal way, and to get their books signed and have a little fun.
Are these chefs also customers of yours?
Many of them, yeah. We rely a lot on professional chefs to build up our business, and for that audience, we carry a lot of things that are would be probably close to unsaleable elsewhere, but which are like candy to somebody who makes their living preparing and creating new food. Our biggest seller this year is a book from Copenhagen, which is in English, from a young chef named Ronnie Emborg, who has a book called The Wizard's Cookbook, and it's exquisitely photographed, very ambitious food. I would never suggest it as a host or hostess gift for a weekend in the country, but for somebody who's got to come up with new plating ideas and new food all the time, it's an enormous boost to imagination and creativity.
I've seen the book. I haven't quite flipped through it. It kind of makes me want. It makes me think it's like a Harry Potter, like
a magical world. Well, the title suggests that a little bit, but it's actually an incredibly precise book. The mm-hmm. recipes are followable if you have the ingredient access and the time. It's very seriously put together, but it's also a great testament to the way one guy's mind works, mm-hmm. and you can really get inside his head and see how he's putting dishes together. But we're importing books for that audience quite regularly. It's a big part of what I spend my time on.
I do want to talk about that, the importing side of the business, or the sourcing maybe out of print items. How can you, like, walk me through, if there's a book I wanted and I call you, I email you, what would I do and what would you do?
Well, it would depend on whether the book you're asking about is currently available somewhere in the world, or whether we have to find a secondhand copy for you. If it's new, if it's still in print from the publisher, I'm probably the one who's going to tackle it. If it's an out-of-print book, Nock would definitely be the person who would go after it. His expertise in tracking down out-of-print far exceeds mine, and his knowledge of books is really targeted to that. We definitely go after anything. I have a list of things to tackle when I get back to the store, the requests that came in over the weekend for things that we might be able to find on some very specialized subjects. Sometimes we can get a relationship struck up with a publisher right away on a new book and have it in a week, even if it's coming from overseas. Sometimes it takes a lot longer. Sometimes the struggle is to get it for you at a good price. We work very hard to keep things like shipping costs down, but in some ways you can't avoid the fact that it costs a lot of money to get a book up, you know, mm-hmm. up from Australia or so forth. But we don't give up on searches for books, whether they're brand new or older, and we're always getting in touch with people every day and saying, it's here, finally.
Do you have, like, your Italy contact and your London contact, and you're like, okay, we think this book might be here, so we're going to call this guy?
In some places we have a lot better arrangements, where we have a sort of a centralized authority that we can begin with, but in many cases it's a matter of establishing a new relationship with each book, particularly on the foreign things. In Spain, for instance, we deal with half a dozen publishers regularly, and a lot of others on a time-to-time basis. Italy is even more so. It's a place of enormous creativity and a great deal of idiosyncrasy in the way that that ordering takes place. That's part of the adventure. We get to know people and learn from them. And some of the people we've been dealing with overseas now for more than 20 years.
And what are some current releases that are out there or some that you're looking forward to? You mentioned Bitter coming up in the fall as well, and some other events of chefs that are have books coming out. I know Heritage is coming from Sean Brock. But what's out right now or coming soon that you're really looking forward to?
Well, it's funny. One of our most successful books in the last 2 months that is domestically published is actually a pair of books on butchering, and both for beef and for poultry, by a young man named Adam Danforth. They're very explicit, very detailed guides, and we've been selling them like crazy. I mean, I thought they would be strong, but I'm really impressed by the way that they've taken off. That's just been incredibly satisfying for us. We're still selling quite well David Levovitz's book on Paris cooking. That's been such a pleasure to dip into over and over again with people and to talk to them about it, because it's a very charming event. We had an event with David about 6 weeks ago that was a big success. It was so big that we had to move it out of the Y into a local high school gymnasium in order to accommodate all the people who wanted to meet him. And that book has just been so sweet and charming. And, you know, as the summer rolls around, there are also some older books that come back into play for us. There's a book called Cucina Fresca by Evan Kleiman and Viana Laplace, which is all food meant to be served cold or room temperature. It's been around for 25 years, maybe more, and every summer it's a terrific thing because people are so excited to have something that doesn't heat up their kitchen and when dinner time rolls around.
Very hot seller in New York then.
Exactly. And, you know, people take it out to their beach houses or to visit friends in the country. Absolutely.
Oh, very cool. I'll have to check that out. I'm not familiar. So, and are there any sleepers, like books that you are just loving but aren't selling like hotcakes and you kind of wish they were getting some more play?
I think every bookseller has those books that they personally fall in love with and expect to do better. I haven't been struck by that really recently about something coming along slowly. I have to say I'm
satisfied.
I mean, there are years when I'm beating my head against the wall trying to get people interested in books. It's definitely a common phenomenon, but lately I've been very pleased with the way people have been excited about the stuff that we like.
Good. Well, it's funny, when I was doing, you know, some background research on you and also hearing you speak, you know, talking about where the books are kept and talking about sourcing them from different brokers per se overseas, about finding this one special kind of gem. A lot of parallels to wine, which is kind of where I come from and a comfort zone for me. So are you insured? Is your collection insured?
Yes. I can say that we've had very good luck with insurance. We had a flood.
That's what I'm thinking. Like, I picture this nightmare scenario of all these books underground in your store, and I'm like, oh,
a pipe burst in our basement about 15 years ago. Actually, not in our part of the basement, but elsewhere in the basement. But it flooded probably only about 3 inches of water, but that was enough to really set us back. And that cost us some books that we really loved, but... Yeah, we take that part very seriously.
Absolutely. Temperature control and, like, no UV light. And
We haven't gotten to temperature control yet, but we're always fussing with things. And there are certain things in the store that are scarcer and more valuable and require, you know, being kept and stored differently than your average brownie book.
Yeah. So not that you maybe have much time, but are there any books that you read besides cookbooks and, like,
I do. I read a lot of history.
Okay.
I find it helps enrich my knowledge, my understanding of what we do in the store. But I'm happy to curl up with a piece of fiction on the weekend just for a change. I read a lot of Dickens.
Okay. Interesting. And what about food zines? Is that what people call them now? All these magazines. I think that's maybe been a change that you've experienced.
Yeah. There's been a real proliferation of those magazines. And I think some very good creative things are happening there, partly because they're happening away from big mainstream publishing houses and you see people taking risks. I really love Fool, which is a magazine that comes out twice a year from Sweden. We do very nicely with that. We've always done really well with Edward Baer's Art of Eating newsletter, which I think is some of the best food writing published in America. America, just on a, you know, day in, day out basis, they really do a fine job. But we like Gastronomica, which is really more concerned with food culture, or Petit Propos Culinaire, which is a gathering place for food historians. Mm-hmm. And all of those really find an audience among our customers.
And you have overseas magazines as well?
We do.
Obviously, you said Fool.
Yeah.
But other maybe ones that people aren't as familiar with, that are very like micro in different countries.
I don't know that I can burrow quite that in on magazines. Mm-hmm. We do carry Apicius, which is a chef showcase magazine that comes out of Spain. It doesn't feature just Spanish chefs, but it is sort of spawned by that creativity that you see in the Spanish restaurant movement, and also a pastry magazine called So Good, which features rising stars in the pastry world, beautifully plated desserts and so forth. Those sell phenomenally well for us.
Excellent. Well, I really feel like I could ask you a million other questions and talk to you all day about books and food, but we're about out of time. So, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time out away from the store and coming to hang out with us here. I encourage everyone to check out Kitchen Arts and Letters. It's located on Lexington Avenue between 93rd and 94th Street. And if you can't make it to the store, you can always check it out online, kitchenartsandletters.com, spell out and. And that's all for Eat Your Words today. I'm Brianna Kurtz. We'll see you next Monday at 1 p.m., where we'll be talking to Heritage Radio's founder, Patrick Martins, about his new book, The Carnivore's Manifesto.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.